This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Coming up, we check in at the United Nations in New York City, where talks are underway that could lead to some movement, at least toward peace in Syria. What happens now that most of the world's nations have at least tentatively agreed to curb climate change?
So a simplistic analysis would say, well, that means you're going to kill the coal industry and the oil companies, and if you have less coal, less oil, that means the economy will suffer. I don't think that that's been borne out in the evidence.
Stay with us for that point of view, and it's predicted to be the hottest movie in years. The latest Star Wars film has opened in the United States and Europe. We'll hear from BOA's Penelope Pulu. She's been lucky enough to have seen it already. All right here on The Voice of America. We begin on International Edition in New York City, where world powers have gathered for the third round of talks on a proposed Syrian political transition just weeks before a plan to launch UN-mediated talks between the Syrian government and the opposition. Joining us now from New York is VOA's United Nations correspondent, Margaret Bashir. Margaret, just a day or so ago, we were being told that there was a possibility of something actually or some conclusion actually being reached today. Is that going to happen?
Well, these are really preparatory talks right now, Ira. The Syrians aren't participating in them, so nothing is going to happen in the sense that the Syrian parties are going to come to a conclusion or a decision or something. But what's happening right now, this is kind of part three of what was happening in Vienna in October and November. So we have the U.S. and Russia leading the talks, and there's several countries involved, more than a dozen other countries, including key regional players like Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Iran, and they are working on issues to basically get us to interrupt Syrian talks. So when they say that there might be something out of them today, the goal, the idea today is to come from, you know, they're meeting at a hotel in New York City. The idea is to move from the hotel to the United Nations Security Council in the afternoon and have the Security Council, the 15 members of the Security Council, agree a resolution endorsing the talks and endorsing sort of the roadmap for peace for Syria. But as of now, we don't know whether that the negotiating partners on the resolution will be able to achieve a consensus. So we don't know yet if there'll be a resolution. I think it's probably likely. I think that the Russians and the Americans want a resolution, and I think that they will try and overcome their differences and make the gap smaller so that they can come to some sort of consensus, because there really is finally momentum on Syria, and I think it's important that they, you know, throw their weight behind it to keep that momentum going.
When is the last time you can remember the United States and Russia being on the same page?
Well, so we've had a lot of problems in the Council for almost 5 years now between Russia and the U.S. on Syria. They haven't agreed on the political aspect of the Syrian crisis and how to solve it. But they have actually cooperated on the elimination of Syria's chemical weapons arsenal. They have agreed on the need for humanitarian aid to go in across conflict lines and across borders. So they have come together on some aspects of the crisis. But really, they have always... And it's not just the U.S. and Russia. It's the West and Russia. They keep falling on different sides of the political coin because the Russians support President Assad, and they have backed him throughout this war. And the Westerners say we can't. He's lost his legitimacy. We can't support a man who's gassed his people, who barrel bombs his people, and who starves his people.
So in the context of the talks that are ongoing, what are the most contentious issues? You mentioned the possibility of some just a second ago, but what are the most contentious issues here?
Well, there are at least really three unresolved issues. And one of them is which groups in Syria will be defined as terrorists. The Jordanians have been tasked with this. They are compiling a list of all the armed groups in Syria, and they're setting up some sort of matrix or criteria for who's a terrorist and who's not, because if you're a terrorist, you can't go to the intra-Syrian talks that they're hoping to start in January. So this is one of the issues. Another one is whether the Security Council would recognize the bloc of Syrian opposition groups that came together in Saudi Arabia last week, because the Saudis hosted a meeting that was also part of the preparations, and they got the Syrian opposition together, and they chose about 30 people who will be in their delegation once this moves, hopefully in January if it stays on track, once it moves to intra-Syrian talks. So that's one issue. Will the council recognize who the opposition delegation will be? And the third really is the one where Russia and the U.S. diverge the most, and this is on the fate of President Assad. Should he be allowed to run for another term? Because part of the roadmap for Syria is to try and achieve a nationwide ceasefire to get the intra-Syrian talks going, and these two things would happen in parallel, and then have elections in 18 months, like work our way to a transition with elections in 18 months. And so that question is, will President Assad be allowed to run in those elections? And, of course, the West is saying no, and Russia is saying maybe.
Well, these are interesting questions. These are very serious and important questions, and VOA's Margaret Bashir will be at the United Nations reporting on them. As always, Margaret, thanks.
Thanks, Ira.
Meanwhile, U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter is in Afghanistan. That's been hit by an increasing number of violent attacks, especially in the eastern areas where the Islamic State terror group is active. Carter met with Afghanistan's acting defense minister, Mohammad Massoum Stanakzai, after other Afghan officials, and also delivered holiday greetings to U.S. troops in the South Asian nation.
I'm here partly to wish our service members a happy holiday, because it's obviously holiday time for us, and remembering that they're here and not at home, but that they're here doing a noble thing, which is working with our Afghan partners and the rest of our coalition partners to help Afghanistan protect it and build itself, and at the same time be an enduring friend.
In response to the increased violence, President Obama has decided to keep nearly 10,000 American troops in Afghanistan through most of 2016. And a new Pentagon study is out. It says there have been 27% more high-profile attacks in Kabul compared to last year. Let's check in on what people are saying on social media today. VOA social media guru Andrew Palshevsky joins us. And while I relearn how to speak the English language, Andrew, you tell us what's going on, okay?
Well, today is International Migrants Day, so this is getting a lot of play on social media, people using the hashtag #IAmAmigrant to share their stories. And this is really where social media is set apart from other instances where the facts and figures are being shared. Social media allows that personal connection. So you have a lot of people sharing their stories, talking about their families that came as migrants, they themselves that came as migrants, and really adding to a lot of the other facts and figures that places like the UN are sending out. So it's a nice personal touch, a nice connection as the world marks that holiday, International Migrants Day. And then, of course, the big news, Star Wars The Force Awakens. Seems like everybody is talking about that on social media in one form or another. And there are lots of fans that are reviewing the movie and talking about what they think, trying not to spoil the movie for others.
You've seen it already?
I have not seen it, but I have talked to people who have, and they have given it rave reviews. The interesting thing we're seeing now, we were talking about this a bit before the show, is that other companies are trying to jump on the success of Star Wars. So you have on social media especially things like United Airlines tweeting out, for those traveling far, far away, enjoy your flight. The Sierra Club here in the U.S., which is an environmental group, says, may the forest be with you. So trying to jump on some of that with some very corny puns. But ones that are getting shared quite a lot on social media.
Marketing people are just genius, aren't they?
Yeah, they're loving this and enjoying the fact that they can try to fit any puns that they can into it. Another thing that's actually been trending, a viral video, a weather presenter in the United Kingdom fit in 12 different Star Wars references and puns in a 40-second weathercast. So she's getting a lot of praise for that and a lot of shares on social media.
Yeah, well, may the farce be with you. Andrew Palshevsky with us on social media. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
Thank you. This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. At the United Nations talks in Paris last week, nearly 200 nations agreed to curb carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions, limiting temperature rise to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Now, while the mood of all this was jubilant, the question remains whether nations can really meet the goal and avoid the most catastrophic impacts of climate change, especially among island nations and in the developing world. I spoke with Professor Eric Orts about that. He is the director of the Initiative for Global Environmental Leadership at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia.
I think there's an assumption from many that when you take steps to reduce your fossil fuels, for example, and a simplistic analysis would say, well, that means you're going to kill the coal industry and the oil companies, and if you have less coal, less oil, that means the economy will suffer. I don't think that that's been borne out in the evidence. So that would it's sort of like saying if we get rid of horses for transportation, partly because they're kind of messy to have as your basic transportation in cities, somehow that's going to reduce your economy. It doesn't take into account the fact that there are lots of investments in new technologies that are going to be coming online, are going to be creating jobs and investments. And that's also not to say that there's not going to be disruptions. There will be some winners in this, and there will be losers. My general feeling is that if you take all of the costs and burdens into consideration, this will be long-term positive for the global economic as well as the environmental system.
But can some of the nations, can some of the individuals, let's say a coal miner in West Virginia, a coal miner in China, what happens to these people's lives and how long will this turnaround take? Is it going to be somebody's lifetime or what?
I think we already see it happening. So you already see coal companies going out of business, for example. If you look at China, there's going to be they have committed to, and I think that the leadership in China recognizes now that you can't just keep burning as much coal as possible and have no economic as well as environmental effect. Now you're right; there's going to be disruptions from coal. If you move from one energy source to another, you're going to have disruptions. You know, there's no whaling industry anymore, where you're basically killing whales to have oil. There are other sources of oil that have been found. But there are one of the big changes here is going to be if you look at solar right now, the cost of solar is declining rapidly. The investments of batteries and other methods to store energy when it's produced by solar or by wind or other renewable sources is increasing. And you also have the possibility of new nuclear, and I think that many environmental groups have come on board to supporting nuclear energy as a significant breakthrough technology. There are some new possible technologies and breakthroughs that you could have in the research in that field. So, and that's not, you know, there, and then that's not to consider lots of other areas where you can basically have a shift that's going to mean business opportunities. And at the same time, you're right, there's still going to be disruptions, but disruptions always occur in our economy. You know, there's always going to be some who are in a technology where you make horse whips, for example, and there's not really the same demand today as there had been when you had an economy based on horses.
This seems to pose an advantage for investors, does it not? Where do you see changes going there?
Well, I think that there are many people looking at this. I think investments are very important. So you can look at this at a couple of different levels. One is, if you're a company, then you need to take a look at what your own profile is here. And are there risks as there are going to be progressively increased regulations of certain kinds or increased expectations that you have from investors, customers, employees, et cetera, whether you are set up with a correct strategy going forward? And that depends on the company, on how far of a time horizon you can have. And I think for the most part, if you actually look at companies today, I would say they're ahead of the curve. Many of the bigger companies are ahead of the curve of the political discussions or most people's understandings, where they see the future and they realize that this is a risk that they need to manage. Now, for lots of other companies, there's also opportunities here. So as you're going to have a major shift here and change, then what you want to look at. Is there opportunity in investing in some of the new startups on the new investment? That's not to say that, you know, throwing money after into green technology or what had been called clean tech is always going to be a win. There had been a wave of clean tech investments that had occurred maybe 3 or 4 years ago that basically cratered. And there were a lot of venture capitalists who lost a lot of money when some of those technologies did not come through, or when you didn't have regulation that supported them. But that doesn't, I think, still long term, it's a question of timing, and it's a question of getting the right investments. There are going to be opportunities, and that companies are that investors are going to be increasingly looking at that.
That is Professor Eric Ortz, Director of the Initiative for Global Environmental Leadership at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Now, the International Energy Agency, says global demand for coal, the biggest source of man-made carbon emissions, stalled last year for the first time since the 1990s. In a report issued today, the Paris-based IEA cited declining appetite for coal in China, the world's biggest coal consumer. China is expanding renewable sources of electricity, such as hydro, wind, and solar power, also nuclear. It's also seen a decline in coal-intensive industries like steel and cement. The IEA projected that the share of coal in power generation worldwide would drop from the current 41% to 37% by 2020, though demand for coal is projected to rise in India and throughout Southeast Asia. The IEA chief, Faith Birol, said environmental policies, including last week's climate agreement in Paris, will likely continue to constrain global coal demand. This is International Edition. Recognize that music. It is the theme from Star Wars, and as unless you've been hiding under a rock somewhere, you know that the newest Star Wars has just come out, at least in the United States and parts of Europe, and it's getting rave reviews. VOA's Penelope Pulu has seen the movie and also covered the throngs of people who are going out to see it. What'd you think of the movie, Penelope?
Thumbs up, Ira. It is a great film. I think it is a great continuation to the original ones. Nobody's going to be disappointed.
Why? I mean, what does it have that some of the others didn't?
First of all, it has the technology. We are seeing this on IMAX, 3D. The space battles are larger, bigger than ever. So you are going to enjoy that part. The script is wonderful, the story. It's a fairy tale of good versus evil. The new cast is unbelievable. I think that whoever did the casting did a masterful job, knowing that this is a billion-dollar venture and we cannot mess this up. And these new young people are playing next to the iconic characters, so that's not a small feat either.
That makes it very special as well, doesn't it?
Yes.
J.J. Abrams, what do you think he lent to this?
First of all, his enthusiasm as a fan. You can tell that this is a kid in a toy store.
By the way, we should say that J.J. Abrams is the director of this latest movie.
Absolutely. He's the filmmaker. He loves the franchise. He grew up with that, and he brings all this enthusiasm in him, but he also tries to stay true to the actual story of George Lucas. But he also brings in his new story with the new people, applying to the young generation sensibilities.
Now, you also covered, as I said, the throngs of people going to see the movie. You were outside one of the Smithsonian IMAX movie theaters. What is all this frenzy about?
Okay, this was very special, I have to say, because I wasn't exactly outside. I was actually inside the theater, under the gaze of all these space shuttles and all this aviation history, and to have all these people dressed up as their favorite characters, talking about the battles and the TIE fighters and the sabers. And then the director of the Smithsonian Movie Theaters was there raving about this IMAX technology, bringing in all these very stark black hues and colors onto the screen. So you have this depth of the galaxies 10 times stronger, tenfold, to the original one. So it was really special to see that enthusiasm, that energy.
How unique is it that so many people are still nerdy fans of the Star Wars movies? It's been a while. It's been a long time since the first one came out. I was much younger than I am right now. And why has it lasted so long? What is it about the Star Wars franchise that keeps people glued to it?
It's the fairy tale. It is this collective myth that people have decided somehow to adopt and to accept into their hearts. And a lot of people are going to come and tell you their personal stories, how they grew up as children of a divorced family or with adversities at school or whatever, and how each one of these heroes somehow spoke to them, be that the heroes of the good or the anti-hero who brought in the dark force and the power. But a lot of people felt empowered by that collective tale and still are. A lot of younger kids continue the myth because they grew up with that, because their parents loved it. So, you know what I like? That humanity finds its voice and it is collective brotherhood through popular culture. And that, to me, in a dark world like we live today, it is incredibly special.
And I'm going to wait in line and go see it today. Thank you so much, Penelope Pulo. Greatly appreciate it.
You're welcome, Ira. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us on International Edition. Make sure you stay up to date on what's going on in the world. Check out our webpage at voanews.com. Also, podcast, all kinds of good stuff. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In mid-December, the U.S. Department of State designated Emre Erdogan, a Turkish-born German national, as a global terrorist. Erdogan, who is not related to Turkish President Recep Erdogan, has joined and fought with the Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab militant groups. He raised funds for both groups and recruited foreign fighters. In the spring of 2012, Emre Erdogan traveled to Kenya from Somalia, where he had fought on behalf of the Al-Shabaab terrorist group. He is also suspected of carrying out further terrorist activities in Kenya as well as in Uganda. In June 2012, Erdogan was captured in Tanzania and extradited to Germany. There he was tried and convicted in January 2014 for joining militant groups in Pakistan and Somalia and phoning in a false threat of attacks in Pakistan and Germany in November 2010. He is now serving a 7-year prison sentence for these crimes. So what does the United States hope to achieve by designating a terrorist who's already in prison? By designating Emre Erdogan a specially designated global terrorist under Executive Order 13224, the United States effectively freezes his property and bank accounts, thus preventing his assets from falling into the hands of like-minded individuals. Once he has served his sentence, he will find it difficult to travel and to access financial services. The designation also notifies the U.S. public as well as the international community that Emre Erdogan has been actively engaged in terrorism. Designations also complement the law enforcement actions of other U.S. agencies and other governments. By designating Emre Erdogan, the United States is taking a decisive step towards starving him and the terrorist organizations with which he is affiliated of their resources, disrupting their ability to execute their deadly agendas, and ensuring they find it ever more difficult to carry out their acts of violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.